This is KRCU's Going Public. I'm Dan Woods. Marissa Ann Lewis Thompson is off this week. Southeast Missouri has a rich history, and every week on Almost Yesterday, Dr. Frank Nickel takes us to specific moments in time and shares the stories behind significant people and events that have impacted our region. Recently, Frank stopped by to tell us more about the man known as the Father of Physical Culture, who was the predecessor of Charles Atlas and a number of individuals who emphasized bodybuilding and nutrition as the keys to a long and healthy life. Here's our conversation. So what can you tell us about Bernard McFadden, Frank?
Well, I think he's one of the more interesting people that I have encountered in Southeast Missouri. Bernard McFadden was born in, of all places, Mill Spring, Missouri. Small town.
Yeah.
In Wayne County. He grew up, obviously, a poor farm family situation. He was orphaned at age 11. Both his mother and father died. He was sent to live with another Wayne County farm family who worked him rather hard.
Wow.
They took him in. Now, they assumed the responsibility for him, but in exchange, they wanted him to work. He worked hard, baled hay, put up hay,
that's hard work.
Shucked corn,
yeah.
Took care of cattle, hogs, sheep. Mm-hmm. He found that his hard work and the good food they had on the farm, healthy, wholesome food, made him healthy. And he became muscular and he became strong. And he became one of the stronger kids in the neighborhood in Wayne County. But at age 13, that farm family did not want to continue the responsibility of him. The mother became pregnant with another child. And so Bernard McFadden, his original name was Bernard, went to St. Louis and lived with another family.
Why did he change his name, Frank?
He changed his name from Bernard to Bernard because he thought it sounded more masculine later on.
Okay.
He just thought Bernard was a little bit too fancy for what he aspired to.
Interesting.
And when he got into St. Louis, he sought a job and he became kind of an errand boy delivering messages in St. Louis for Western Union. Hmm. Spent a lot of his time inside, and he began to be sickly. He got sick that winter with a severe cold, and he believed it was the absence of physical labor that led him to become ill. So he changed his lifestyle. He began to be a person dedicated to diet, healthy food, to exercise, and to fasting. He would occasionally see if he could fast an entire week and live on water.
Wow.
For a week. He would not eat bread, which he called the staff of death, and became a vegetarian. He came to believe that walking, barefooted especially, was the essential connection to the earth, and that everyone who was able, physically able, should walk 6 miles a day barefoot on the soil, not on concrete or bricks, but on earth, because he said there is strength in the earth that can be absorbed through physical contact with a human foot. So he believed that by eliminating meat and bread from his diet, you could actually achieve a lifespan of 150 years, and that was his goal. He told everyone who questioned his not eating meat, well, just wait. I'm going to live to be 150. You may die at 75, but I'm going to live to 150.
Let me ask you this, Frank. So talking about being a vegetarian at this time, was this a really radical idea?
This was very unusual. Now, there had been people who had tried this in the first half of the 19th century when Sylvester Graham and a lot of other people began to take a look at American diets that they said were full of grease, full of meat and fat and alcohol. Just all the wrong things for the body, harmful to the body. And so McFadden believed that he could live to be 150 years if he walked 6 miles every day barefooted on the soil, if he ate no meat, if he ate no bread, and if he could get everyone else to do this, he said we could change this whole country. It would be the healthiest place in the world. Kind of interesting attitude.
You're listening to Going Public on KRCU. This is Dan Woods, and I'm talking with Frank Nickel about Bernard McFadden, an early bodybuilding and nutrition pioneer from Mill Spring, Missouri. Frank continues his story by telling me about McFadden building restaurants that served healthy foods.
He was borrowing money and building these restaurants that were serving only vegetables no meat and no bread, and he began to call them healthatoriums. You could go there and get a vegetarian meal, and then he would show you how to exercise and how to lift weights and run in place and do sit-ups and push-ups and things of this sort. And he was dedicated to that. And it kind of caught on for a while. There were a number of people who began to change their lifestyle. Because in the 1890s, 1880s, 1890s, there was a major transition in American society. People were moving to cities. They didn't have places to exercise or to work out. They were all working in offices. Mm-hmm. That's one of the motivations for the foundation of the Boy Scouts, for instance, same time period. And so McFadden believed that there was an alternative to the indoor lifestyle of Americans who were overweight, weak, and sickly, and breathing coal smoke in all of those cities. So he was seeking some answer to that. He started publishing articles and eventually expanding them into books. He published over 100 books about health and nutrition, and the names of some of them are How to Raise a Strong Baby, Truth About Tobacco, which he abhorred. Mm. He said we should not use tobacco at all. Making Old Bodies Young, How to Keep People Alive, Active, and Physical into their 90s and over 100. He said every adult male should be able to live to be over 100 years of age. But you can do it only by exercise and proper nutrition.
Now, he didn't have a medical background of any type, right?
He did not have a medical background. So he's just seeking this as a personal observation of his own life. It became popular, obviously, as Americans found living in crowded cities close together, there was a tendency to have greater number of epidemics, cholera, yellow fever, and so forth spread. No one knew the reason for that. But a lot of this is about success. How do you live a healthy and happy life? He became friends with people like Clark Gable, Rudolph Valentino, and a very good friend with Franklin Roosevelt. And there are pictures of Roosevelt and he at Warm Springs, Georgia. Roosevelt invited him to come down to Warm Springs, Georgia. Roosevelt suffering from polio, McFadden prescribed exercises for Roosevelt that would help build up the muscles of his leg. And he tried to get Roosevelt to walk.
Really?
And to take steps and to do that barefoot after his encounter with polio. So he became a famous individual and became quite wealthy, built a huge house, traveled to Europe, even had a contest in England for the perfect woman. And when he selected that one, he divorced his wife and married her.
The perfect one.
And they had, she was the perfect woman. He thought he was the perfect man.
Okay.
And between the two of them, they could have perfect children. And he actually, with his wife, had 8 children, all of whom had first names that began with the letter B, as he did.
Hmm.
He considered, he had enough money and enough fame that he considered running for president of the United States.
Wow.
Didn't get very far with that. He was disappointed So he ran for mayor of New York City. That's kind of an alternative objective of his. And he wanted to be a U.S. senator from the state of Florida. He's just an interesting fellow who had a personal belief that extreme strenuous exercise, contact with the earth, and a healthy diet would all make you live to be healthy, wealthy, and wise, which he was. Did not make 150. He lived 87, which is not too bad
no.
at that particular time when the average life expectancy was about 45. He developed a urinary infection. His wife advised him to go to a scientific doctor. He refused to do that. The infection simply absorbed his body, and he died. He rejected all scientific medicine. He died at age 87.
Frank Nickel is the host of Almost Yesterday and has been talking to us about Bernard McFadden, a bodybuilding and nutrition pioneer from Mill Spring, Missouri. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you very much.
And coming up after the break, Candace Davis talks with Lindsay Grogene about the Missouri Department of Conservation's black bear den checks. You're listening to KRCU's Going Public. We'll be right back.
I'm Ari Shapiro. If you find NPR reliable and comforting, you're not alone. If your old car is a bit less than reliable, well, you're not alone either. Donate your car to us and turn it into the programs you love.
Visit KRCU.org and click on support for all the details. This is KRCU's Going Public. I'm Dan Woods, in for Marissa Ann Lewis Thompson. Southeast Missouri State University recently launched the Red Hawk Food Pantry, joining over 400 other colleges across the country to help students who don't have enough to eat. A recent student government study at Southeast indicated that 15% of students had an inadequate food supply at least four times during the semester. I spoke with Southeast President Dr. Carlos Vargas as part of the television program Focus on Southeast and asked him about the pantry and why it's so important.
I would like to make a statement here. I am very troubled by the fact that we have students, even one is too many, that actually go hungry the semester. And the statistics that you have read clearly demonstrate that. So I am extremely excited about the fact that the university came together and put this in place. And I'd like to take the opportunity to acknowledge Dr. McAllister in the office of the provost. He's the vice provost who actually, as advisor to Lambda Chi Alpha, which is the fraternity whose national philanthropic platform is Feed America, worked with them and submitted a proposal for funding for results that resulted in a $15,000 grant that will cover the project's initial startup costs and limited operational expenses. So that's quite a project, and I'm very happy. So I would like to acknowledge him and the fraternity. It's wonderful that they're doing this. So having said that, the idea here is to give an opportunity for students that are going hungry to have a place to go and get non-perishable items and be able to satisfy that need that they have.
One of the things we've talked about a lot, and you talk about a lot, is retention and graduation rates. How does this impact retention and graduation rates?
Well, certainly, if a student is able to be well nourished, that student is going to be more concerned with learning, with doing well in his or her studies. A person that's suffering of hunger is not in a position to really pay much attention to the studies that they're here to do. So not only is this something that can benefit those students that are going hungry, but also it really does provide, I believe, an incentive for other students here to stay around because they see the university caring about the student population. That's what I see. I see students helping students. And in some ways, the university is sort of like a catalyst for that, but it's giving students in general an opportunity to to show their compassion, to show how they care for others. And I think that develops a sense of community, and that sense of community makes you more, attaches you more to the campus. And so overall, you end up with students who care more about the institution, and then they care about staying around and finishing their degree here.
That was part of my conversation with Southeast President Carlos Fargas about the Red Hawk Food Pantry. The university hopes to have the pantry fully operational by fall 2017. The Missouri Department of Conservation is currently conducting black bear den checks, part of the Missouri Black Bear Research Project. KRCU's Lindsay Grogeen spoke with the Missouri Department of Conservation's Candace Davis to learn more about it.
All right, so I'm here with Candace Davis from the Missouri Department of Conservation. And over the past decade, she says that Missouri Department of Conservation has seen a rise in the black bear population, which it's giving them the opportunity to do some research. So tell us about it, Candace.
So we've had the Missouri Black Bear Research Project for several years now, but what we're currently doing, our bear biologists and other biologists are out doing black bear den checks. So what this is we have female bears that have previously had radio collars put on them so we can find them. And this is the season where they are denned up and hopefully have some cubs. So we want to know about their population numbers and also the health of the bears. So what they do is they go out, they track the bears, they find them in the den, they sedate the mom bear, they measure any cubs, count the cubs, of course, measure, weigh them, get some information on their health status. They also examine the mother, see how her collar is. If she needs a new one, they put that on them. And it just helps us to know how the bears are doing and helps us keep our count of the bears.
All right. And why is it important that you all keep the count? And tell me what the process is in like getting those bears and doing your research.
So one of the things I want to emphasize is, you know, as folks see pictures of the bears and the bear cubs, they look super cute and cuddly, you know, but that's not what we're there for. We're not petting the bears. We're not naming them or anything like that. They're being measured and we're collecting data. So the biologists are minimizing their interactions with the bears because it's very important that we keep them wild so we don't get them accustomed to being around humans. So they're minimizing their contact, but getting their information, collecting their data. And then and while the mother bear is sedated, and then they put the cubs back with the mother, let her wake up on her own and recover.
Where was the black bear population before they started kind of, are they migrating towards Missouri and kind of the Midwest or kind of a timeline?
If you go back to look at when bears left Missouri, you'd have to go back all the way to the late 1800s, early 1900s. And that was overhunting before we had hunting regulations in place that would have caused that. Now, where have they come from now? That's a great question. There is some speculation that some of them have come up from Arkansas because Arkansas did a repopulation effort with black bears in their state. And we have tested the DNA in our bears, and some of the DNA is true to that. Some of the DNA has also showed that we have bears that are regionally specific, came from the Missouri Ozark. So that's very exciting to see that some of them did survive.
So what can we do to avoid conflicts with bears and keep them in the wild?
There are several things that people can do to help keep bears wild, especially if you live in a rural area that's near some of this continuing forest where bears are, which is the Missouri Ozarks, and it comes eastern into southeast Missouri also. And one thing you can do is around your home, keep things tidy. If you have pet food, make sure you put that away where bears can't get to it. Birdseed, put that up high where a bear can't reach it. Anything that's good smelling, a bear is going to smell it and think that might be a food source. And bears are habitual animals. So if they learn that they can get a free meal somewhere, they're going to return to that free meal. And we don't want to do that. We have a saying that goes, a fed bear is a dead bear. Because if a bear thinks, oh, I can come back to this place every day and find an unsecured trash can where there's a free meal, I'll come back. Well, that's when humans have conflict with bears and the bear meets its demise. So we want to keep bears wild. Bears are native to our state. They belong here. They're a great wildlife species to have in our state. And it's a compliment to us that they're here because we have the habitat to support them.
All right. Well, I think that's all we really need for today. Thank you so much for coming in, Candace.
Thank you very much for having me.
Candace Davis is the media specialist for the Missouri Department of Conservation's Southeast and Ozark regions, and she also is the host of KRCU's Discover Nature. She spoke with KRCU's Lindsay Grogi. That's our show for this week. You can find these stories on our website at krcu.org or find us on iTunes to hear this show as a podcast. I'm Dan Woods. Join us every Friday night at 6 and Sunday afternoon at 3 for KRCU's Going Public.